Back to sports and the infamous Ted Koppel interview with Al Campanis and my insistence that he quit. It wasn't that Al Campanis was a bad man. He came from a family of first-generation Greek immigrants in New York, and in that environment of suspicion and class and race hatred, Campanis had not merely grown up, he had risen. By the time he was 29 years old, he had befriended an African-American, the first play in the minors since 6 months before Al Campanis was born. Played alongside him, helped him, became his friend, stopped thinking of him as a black man. By the age of 39, Al Campanis was scouting players for the Dodgers, looking not for the color of a kid's skin, merely for his talents. Al Campanis came a long way, and in his own corner of the world, he helped to wipe out an incredible amount of bigotry. But we all stopped growing eventually, and when he stopped, it was necessary for somebody else to take his place, someone for whom the trip was not from a starting point of racial hatred to a concluding point of blacks are equal except for management, but someone who could begin where Al Campanis left off. And that's what the next generation of athletes and sports reporters and fans has to do. We have gotten to the point where a white executive of a baseball club, Lee Thomas of the Phillies, can look on the field and suddenly realize he doesn't see anything but white faces in his team's lineup, and he can be shamed by that fact, and he can decide to do something about that fact because it suggests in equal measures that A, there's racism afoot, and B, that some idiot in his organization may have thwarted the career of a good ball player because he didn't like the color of the man's skin. We have gotten to the point where biases like Al Campanis's are anathema in sports. The appointment of black coaches, black general managers, black executives, while still not fast enough, just isn't groundbreaking news anymore. We have gotten to the point where I can make a list off the top of my head of the top 10 most visible sportscasters in this country and find that 5 of them are African Americans. And now we need to go to the next stage. We need to make the world safe for Albert Bell to hate my guts and for me to hate his. Not because I'm white and he's black, but because I think he's hurting his business and mine, or because he thinks I'm hurting my business and his. We need to get to the point where I can accuse him of trying to separate Fernando Viña's head from his shoulders and have neither him nor anybody else accuse me of racism. We need to get to the point where he can call me a bad reporter and a lousy judge of his character without Bell being accused of racism himself. Of course, as I think this, I think back also to my nocturnal trips to the supermarket and those cops with those bleaching searchlights and that guy involuntarily hugging the tree at Beverly and Doheny, and I think I get a momentary glimpse into the other side of the mirror. I think those of us who are white see a line of demarcation in our past, a point at which most of the members of our race stopped making things worse and started trying to make things better. But I don't think that supposed line of demarcation is as visible for minorities in this country. If it's gotten 50 degrees warmer in your house since the furnace went on, that's great. If it was 18 degrees before you fixed the damn thing, if it was minus 273, that's another story. I don't want African-American leaders to stop pounding this country about racism. There will always be too much of it to go around. And I'm not going to stop pounding the sports world about racism. And I'm not going to forget the police car's blinding light in Beverly Hills, either. It's just that when racism is accused in a case where it didn't exist, it is sometimes created. It's stuff like that that threatens to undo whatever amount of progress we have achieved already, and threatens how quickly we can complete the progress we must achieve. The plays of the week, or the plays, have been a regular part of SportsCenter for 10 years now, a regular feature on the Sunday night edition of The Big Show, and we enjoy them just as much as you do.
As much as we love our version of America's funniest home videos, without babies' butts and fat guys falling over at weddings, our real fun is writing the introductions to the plays. There's always a theme, and we always try to select 4, 5, or 6 players who fit the theme, but who...
you won't be seeing. Honest to God, we've sometimes spent an hour looking for the names, combing through the encyclopedias, combing through Dan's hair, combing...
just get to the list or I'll discuss your hair.
Ahem. The theme for the plays of the week is the best lead-ins we've ever done. And among those you won't be seeing, hockey goalie Alan Bester, former Cornell soccer coach Jack Ryder, and boxing's Bundini, don't call me Pundini, Brown.
You won't see soccer's George Best, ex-Braves pitcher Bob Introbridge, or former Houston outfielder Johnny Weekly, but you will see the best lead-ins for the plays of the week. Theme, Outer Space Edition. former 76er World Be Free, tennis phenom Venus Williams, and football mortal Bart Starr.
NFL receiver Al Neptune, sports writer Terry Pluto, and of course the familiar chant at college football games, up Mars, up Jupiter, up Uranus. Theme, Deion Sanders Goes Fishing Edition. You won't see former Mets pitcher Jay Hook, ex-Astro catcher John Bateman, or veteran pitcher Steve Trout.
Twins pitcher Bob Kipper, basketball announcer Steve Snapper Jones, Padres first baseman Walleye Joyner. Theme, Beat the Clock Edition, the NBA's Tiki Burden, and hoops coach Bob Spoonhour.
You also won't see football's Buddy Dial, great Pirates reliever Elroy Face, or former Cubs pitcher Bill Hands.
Theme, Miss America Contest Edition. Then Falcons quarterback Jeff, please don't call me Phyllis George, or former 49er Dwayne Boardwalk, and Dave, don't call me Burt Parks.
Former Giants catcher Bill Bathing Suit, and your genial contest hosts, Jerry, don't call me Regis Philbin, and Frank, okay, go ahead and call me Kathy Lee Gifford. Theme, the Rhythm and Blues edition of the Plays of the Week. You won't see former A's infielder Keith Drumright, Steve or Dave Sachs, or former Orioles manager Joe Altobelli.
Ex-Falcon Jeff Van Note, or any of the Blue Notes, Vita Blue, John Blue, Blue Moon Odom, and Blue Edwards. Theme, We've Just Been Sued Edition. The Braves' Dave Justice, former Cleveland Brown lawyer Tillman, or softball legend Eddie Fainer from The King and His Court.
You won't see former Washington Senator Joe Judge, ex-White Sox center fielder Rudy Law, or tennis great Margaret Court. Theme, the Variety of Strange Guttural Noises edition of the Plays of the Week. You won't see former NHL defenseman Doug Moans, ex-Red Sox pitcher Bill Rohr, and the Mariner pitcher of the time, Tim Belcher.
The Reds' Dave Burba, the young Red Sox Brian Bark, or tennis phenom Sabine Hack. Theme, the Valentine's Day edition. Golf's Davis Love III, football's Duval Love, Chicago Bulls great Bob Love, or Colgate basketball player Malik Cupid.
You won't see referee Ted Valentine, Cincinnati Hoops coach Bob Huggins, or hockey's Kelly Kissio, not to mention former Major League Baseball players Greg Hartz, Ben Flowers, and Slim Love. And theme, Olympic edition of the Plays of the Week. You won't see former big league pitchers Dave Gultz, Jim Bronstad, or Silver King.
The Colorado Silver Bullets, former Cowboy Golden Richards, or former twin Steve Braun and his family, the Braunz.
Or for our own awards, the ESPY Awards edition of the Plays of the Week. You won't see ex-Yankee Oscar Gamble, Braves pitcher Tony Cloninger, or songstress Emmy Lou Harris.
You cheated on that one. Baseball's Cecil ESPY and Alvaro Espinoza.
And you cheated on that one, too. Dan and I are approximately the same age. Of course, that doesn't change the fact that he's still older than I am.
Months.
Given that fact, sports-wise, we should have the same interests, the same memories, the same milestones.
Yet when we put together our list of the top sporting events we've actually attended and or covered, we only had one overlap. Our mix of sports isn't even close.
This is a product, we think, of something that is beginning not to exist anymore, regionalism in sports.
Keith and I are from the last generation where these regional interests reign. Look at our list of the greatest thrills we've witnessed in person, and you'll see. Keith, you may do the honors first.
Number one, the Yankees-Red Sox playoff game of October 2nd, 1978. Easily the greatest sporting event I have ever attended, and it happened when I could still be 100% fan and 100% reporter. Instead of vacations, when I was a kid, we used to buy Yankee season tickets. So for the preceding seven seasons, I had been to nearly every Yankee home game.
So you must have really enjoyed that 1976 World Series. Reds, four wins, Yankees just watching.
Shut up! Shut up! It still hurts! Shut up! Well, then comes the fall of 78. I'm seeing all this not just as a Yankee fan, but as an intern slash reporter. The Yankees put on this comeback from 14 games out to the division ending up in a tie for the first time ever. Well, who's been in Boston all weekend watching the Red Sox, the final weekend of the season, but my best friend Jim Berger, an arch Boston fan. He gets playoff tickets for himself, for his wife, and for me. Sunday night, the Yankees TV station in New York televises Pride of the Yankees, which you saw on TV in those days maybe once every 2 years or so. Then Monday morning, I'm on a near-empty flight to Boston. On board, Dick Schaap, American League President Lee McPhail, me. This just keeps getting better and better. We get into Boston, and the day is perfect. And Jim in his Red Sox cap, and Jim's wife Gloria, and me in my Yankee cap, we go to our seats in the very last row behind first base. We're sitting behind these two guys who had been at the last playoff game involving the Red Sox against the Indians in 1948. They're talking about how Lou Boudreau, the Cleveland shortstop, beat the Sox for the pennant with a couple of homers, and how they, then kids, cried all the way home. It is just classic. Then Carl Yastrzemski homers off Ron Guidry of the Yankees, and all of a sudden, it's not feeling so classic anymore. Boston gets another run, and Mike Torres, pitching for the Red Sox, has been getting away with murder against the Yankees. The Yankees have shot their wad. Finally, in the seventh, the Yanks put two guys on, and they send up Jim Spencer to pinch hit, and Torres strikes him out. And my buddy Jim looks at who is coming up off the on-deck circle, and he sighs, and he sits back in his seat, and he says, "Whew, thank goodness, Dent's no home run threat." I turned and I gave him a look from a movie. "Are you nuts?" I say to him. "Have you learned anything from life? From being a Red Sox fan? Don't you know what you've just done? Bucky Dent has to hit the home run now just because you're convinced it can't happen." Well, in that situation, you have to keep your yap shut because whatever deities there are, they are not always listening. But they are always listening at Fenway Park. But I seriously doubt Bucky Dent is going to hit a three-run homer right then merely because Jim Berger has offended something somewhere. And then Dent hits the ball, and this moan grows throughout the ballpark. I can see the smiles of anticipation on the faces of individual Yankee fans sitting 400 feet away from me. The collective moan of the Red Sox fans gets louder. Now it is a shriek of pain, and I turn and I look down at Jim, and I swear the skin is peeled off his face. He thinks he has caused Bucky Dent's home run. Well, the game ends and the crushed Red Sox fans file out past me while I'm on hold in Ithaca waiting to go on the air at our college radio station and talk about the Yankees and how now they're heading to Kansas City. And I see the two guys who had been sitting in front of us, the ones who had been at the playoff game 30 years before, and they're crying again. "Marty," the one says to the other, "maybe we're a jinx." And the irony, of course, is that truly that game marked the day I stopped being a Yankee fan. First off, nothing could ever top that. They won the World Series 3 weeks later, and it was great, but it wasn't close. So as a Yankee fan, I got nothing more to look forward to in life. And I begin to think about all the times Boston fans have been through this before and of what nameless horrors await them in the future. Wait, I see something. They call it Mookie. So it's obvious I'm rooting for the wrong ball club here. Well, I certainly can't go root for the Red Sox. You don't make that kind of switch in just one lifetime. So, greatest game I ever covered, and the end of me as a fan. Not a bad way to go out as a fan, I suppose, but don't tell Jim Berger that.
That story gets longer every time you tell it. It's like I'm listening to Garrison Keillor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. My number one is a little bit shorter and a lot more interesting. Game 6 of the 1993 World Series, October 23rd. I'm covering the game for ESPN with Peter Gammons and Dave Campbell, and we're probably 100 feet away from the left field foul pole sitting in the press box at Skydome.
That's fascinating, Dan.
It gets better. The Phillies take a 6-5 lead into the bottom of the ninth. Mitch Williams is on. First batter he faces is Ricky Henderson. He walks him. Two batters later, he faces Paul Molitor and gives up a base hit. That set the stage for Joe Carter. I remember turning to Peter Gammons saying, "It looks like we're headed for extra innings." And I turned back. Mitch had already delivered the pitch. Joe swung, and the next thing you know, the Toronto bullpen is doing synchronized aerobics. Joe Carter has just entered the World Series. And I immediately thought how happy I was for Joe Carter. Because here's a guy who was once traded from the Cubs to the Indians for Rick Sutcliffe. Sutcliffe went on to win the Cy Young. The Cubs went to the playoffs. Carter then went to the Padres, finally to the Blue Jays. He had never had an opportunity to shine in the postseason. And as he said afterwards, there's a little kid in all of us. We all want to be a hero. And I remember going to the Phillies locker room, and Mitch Williams did not shy away from the media that day. He answered everybody's question. He was brutally honest. He said he thought he slipped off the mound when he delivered the pitch, which the replays would show that he did. But he said, give credit to Joe Carter. He hit an ugly pitch. He hit a pitch that he should have hit out. He refused to go and take a shower, even though some of his teammates tried to pry him away. A couple of months later, I visited Mitch on his ranch outside of Arlington, Texas. I also went to visit Joe Carter in Kansas City. The point of the story was to find out what had happened to these two guys since the home run. Well, Mitch, laid back, riding horses, on his tractor, getting ready to get married, didn't have any problems with it. He said, it's baseball. I threw it. He hit it. He's the hero. I'm the goat. I visited Joe at his home the following week in Kansas City, and I asked him if he was curious at all about how Mitch Williams was feeling. And Carter said, no, not really. If Mitch had gotten me out, I would have been the GOAT. He would have been the hero. And I said, Mitch said the same thing. And Joe said, it's baseball.
Did he ever get that shower, by the way? All right, it's my turn. Number two, Providence Hockey at Cornell, March 5th, 1979.
Wait, you're going to pick a college hockey game as the second greatest sporting event you've ever covered? You need to get out.
I told you we have different backgrounds. There are two things you have to understand as a background to this one. First, at Cornell, hockey was the sport in the 70s. The arena, liner rink, was as noisy as any sports stadium ever. The fans had rituals that would impress and even frighten English soccer hooligans. Second, the squad from the year before had been national championship caliber, but they had been upset in the first playoff game at home by the lowest-seeded team in the tournament, Providence. So who does Cornell draw in the 1979 opener? Providence again. It's a pretty good team, too. The goalie, Brian Milner, went on to the Red Wings for a time, and they had a defenseman named Jim Korn, who spent years in the NHL. The coach was Lou Lamoriello, who went on to be the general manager of the Devils. This was not a pickup team. All right, Cornell's losing 3-0 after two. First minute of the third period, the Friars score again. Cornell gets one back. Providence scores immediately. It's 5-1. Now, I'm the sports director of the Cornell station, WVBR, and I know we're going to have to go into that locker room and do this same brutal post-mortem we had done the year before. We're going to have to go in there and carve up these classmates of ours, and I'm wondering if I'm going to have to go on the air and call for the coach's firing.
You worried about that?
Well, I was 19 at the time. Stop interrupting.
Sorry.
Suddenly, a bank of lights at the Providence end of the ice goes dark, and we see electricians scurrying among the rafters and these big bulbs being moved around, and a minute goes by, and then two, and then five, and the Providence players are just skating around trying to stay focused while the Cornell guys are all over at the bench. And they fix the lights, the electricity comes back on, Cornell scores. It's 5-2. And again, it's 5-3. And they're peppering the net. Each rush, they get five or six shots. 5 minutes left, kid named John Olds makes it 5-4, and now it's like the ice isn't level anymore. Providence can't get out of its own end. Cornell can't score. With a 1:19 left, the freshman Cornell goalie, Brian Hayward, gets pulled. And that's when Providence finally breaks out. A fellow named Randy Wilson busts past the Cornell blue line. He has an uncontested shot on the empty Cornell net with 29 seconds left, and he misses. And Lance Nethery, the Cornell captain, picks the puck up behind his own net and weaves through every Providence player, unloads a slapper on Brian Milner, and he ties it with 13 seconds to play. The overtime was academic. Cornell scored exactly 4 minutes in. Down 4-0, a minute into the third period, they win 6-5 in overtime. Damnedest thing I ever saw, and to this day I am still wondering if somebody deliberately shut those lights off above the Providence net.
Man, I wish I could have been there. My number two is Game 6 NBA Finals, June 17th, 1996.
Wait a minute yourself, Buster. You are picking the anti-climax of all anti-climaxes as your second greatest game? Get me back to liner rink!
I can arrange that. All right, I admit it, the game itself was not memorable. The coronation afterwards was. Michael Jordan had told me that this was probably the toughest time he'd ever gone through in trying to play basketball. His father, the late James Jordan, celebrated with Michael in his three previous championship runs. But his father was killed less than 2 months after Michael won that third title. After winning this one, on Father's Day no less, he told me he couldn't help but think his father should have been there celebrating with him. Jordan was named MVP. If you ask Seattle head coach George Karl, that honor should have gone to Dennis Rodman. Karl told me that Rodman single-handedly won two of those four games with his rebounding, his defense, and his theatrics. We had Rodman on ESPN after the Bulls won the title, and he said to me that he loves to surprise people, that he was still a great basketball player. And then he got up to leave after the interview was over, and he leaned over to me. Now, I thought he was going to kiss me. I see Dennis show up 3 months later in New York wearing a wedding dress, and I realize he was going to kiss me.
Oh, the regrets of romance. You thought they all ended when you got married, huh? Number three, USA-USSR hockey at the 1980 Winter Olympics. I was about a week past my 21st birthday, and I'm in Lake Placid covering the Olympics for UPI Radio, and they have been sending me out to cover this nondescript, boring U.S. hockey team that the experts say has about a 1-in-3 chance of just making the medal round. But the U.S. keeps winning, and all of a sudden they're in the position to clinch the medal and virtually clinch the gold medal. All they have to do is beat the Russians. Now, my boss, Sam Rosen, has been assigned to cover the relevant medal game, so this game is his baby, and he was the backup play-by-play man for the Rangers anyway. But that afternoon, Sam calls me into an ante room in our office, and he says, change of plans. I'm covering the game. You, And with this, he produces a ticket to the game. You are covering the crowd. I got to sit in the stands for the greatest upset in modern Olympic hockey history. And the only time I had to work was after the game, interviewing American fans. Tough life, huh? And I'll always remember the next day inside the Olympic Press Center, next to the cafeteria where the offices of the Russian news service, TASS. I go past their door, the lights are all out, there's nobody in there, and on the window is a hand-lettered sign reading, "Today closed we are." Sort of summed it all up for me.
Final round, Masters Golf Tournament, April 14th, 1996. In any other year, we would have remembered Nick Faldo's closing 67 as one of the greatest final rounds ever by a Masters champ. Instead, we will never forget the 78 turned in by Greg Norman that Sunday afternoon. Through the first two rounds, the media kept talking about how composed Norman was. He was letting the golf course come to him. He was not attacking it as much as he had been in the past. He was being patient. He was brilliant with his putting. After the third round on Saturday, Norman held a six-stroke lead. On Sunday morning, I started to have doubts. Jim Colbert, who was working with me on ESPN at the time, was discussing what Norman had done in the first three rounds. Jim said he was getting the sneaky suspicion that Norman would try to attack the course in the final round, that he would go out and try to run away from everybody. And Jim said if he does it, he could have problems. If he lets the course come to him, as he's been doing in the first three rounds, he should be the winner. I watched the first nine holes on TV like I was driving by a car accident. I knew I shouldn't look, but I knew I couldn't help but look. I went across the street to Augusta National Golf Course, and it was almost as if you were there at a wake. Norman started to press a little bit more. Norman started to attack a little bit more. Meanwhile, Nick Faldo, robo-golfer, continued to play his regimented, robotic style, which had made him one of the greatest players of all time. Here was Faldo, who in previous years had been skewered by the British tabloids, labeled Nick Foldo. I felt bad for Norman that day. He wanted to hide. But how do you hide at the Masters? The first person to comfort him just happened to be Nick Faldo, who would later say, "I just wanted to give Greg a hug." I couldn't wait to hear how Norman would answer questions after the collapse. He said there wasn't a whole lot of anguish. I figured that would come later. He went on to say that you always learn. You try to understand why and what happened. But in situations like that, I may not want to learn about this one. Maybe this one, I just screwed up enough with my own mistakes.
You know, the way you talk about golf, Dan, it's almost interesting. Number four for me was Game 1 of the World Series, October 15th, 1988. I still do not know how the Dodgers had even gotten into that World Series, let alone put us, the media, in the position we were in. I mean, the 3-4-5 hitters for every game of that series against the A's were Mickey Hatcher, Mike Marshall, and John Shelby. While the Dodgers are still losing 4-3 in the bottom of the ninth when all of us TV types go downstairs to prepare to muscle our way into the locker room, and we're watching the game on monitors out by the hot dog stand in the basement of Dodger Stadium. And I can remember a producer from CBS News who worked out of our office sidling over to me and saying, "Sal, what would you like to ask Dennis Eckersley? If they're gonna sweep?" And the same sort of thing came over me that came over me at the Dent game. "Oh no," I said matter-of-factly, "you watch. Old Gimpy's going to come up and pinch hit a homer." And she laughed, and I said, "Just watch." And we watched. And if you ever want to be frightened at a sporting event, be in the basement of a ballpark in earthquake country when Kirk Gibson hits an impossible game-winning homer. Sounded like an 8.2. And this producer and her crew and I and my crew are rushing to get into position to get the Dodgers, storming up their runway to their clubhouse. And she just looks at me and she said, "How did you know?" And I said, "Because I wasn't out in the stands to see it. Same damn thing happened to me at the Chris Chambliss game."
Wait a minute, so you predicted Bucky Dent and Kurt Gibson?
Yes, I did.
Oh, Karnak won.
Honest to goodness.
Speaking of predictions, back to golf. Final round Masters, April 9th, 1995. 10 days before going down to Augusta to cover the Masters for ESPN, I was asked by our producer, Mike McQuaid, who I thought would win that year, who could win that year. And I blurted out Ben Crenshaw's name. Well, Mike, being the golf fanatic that he is, got a very good laugh out of this. Ben had not exactly been on a winning run. Mike proceeded to tell anybody and everybody he came in contact with over the next 15 minutes that I was picking Ben Crenshaw to win the Masters.
We miss Mike on the show some of the time.
3 days later, Crenshaw's lifelong teacher, Harvey Penick, the man who first placed a club in Ben's hands at the age of seven, died in Austin, Texas. Crenshaw chartered an airplane with Tom Kite to attend Penick's funeral on Wednesday, the day before the Masters opening round. Crenshaw played well for the first three rounds, much to the chagrin of my fellow ESPN employees who knew I'd never let them forget that I predicted Ben would win. In the final holes, it was Crenshaw and Davis Love III. And imagine the mixed emotions Love had to be entertaining. Love's father was coached by Penick at the University of Texas. Davis was also close to Harvey. He didn't qualify for the Masters until the previous week in New Orleans. In fact, he won the Freeport Mac Moran the day Harvey Penick died. Ben Crenshaw called Davis during the week and said, "You don't need to go to the funeral. You need to stay here and practice and get ready for the tournament." As Davis would say afterwards, "Once I found out I couldn't win it, I was thrilled for Ben. He lost one of his closest friends, but his thoughts had been about me, hoping I would get ready for the Masters." Crenshaw came to the 18th needing to make a putt from 18 inches away to win it. And he said he had a little talk with himself. He said, "Make this 18-inch putt, and then you can have yourself a good cry." The result was one of the most emotional moments in golf history. Crenshaw making the putt and then collapsing into the arms of his caddy. Crenshaw later said he was not crying for himself. He was crying for Harvey Penick.
Now that's a good golf story. All right, here's my last one. Milwaukee Brewers at Baltimore Orioles, October 3rd, 1982. Could have been one of the greatest games in baseball history. It wasn't. 6 weeks earlier, the Orioles had been 7.5 games behind the Brewers in the AL East race. Then they started winning. It comes down to the final game of the season. These teams are tied and facing each other. There was even more to it than that. Earl Weaver's last game, Jim Palmer pitching, 15-4 going in. He'd pitched the first World Series game I'd ever seen on TV. And the Brewers were going with Don Sutton, whom they had brought in like a Prussian mercenary in a trade with the Astros just before the deadline. So with all this buildup, what happens? The Brewers vivisect Jim Palmer. Game's over in the second inning. No drama, nothing. Brewers 10, Orioles 2. And what's worse, my producer, Phil Griffin, has us stuck in the auxiliary football booth, a little basket hanging from the first base deck that you can only reach by ladder. By the sixth inning, Phil gets the idea that we have to be on the field the moment the game ends so we can get the shots of the Brewers whooping it up. And the Orioles PR director, Bob Brown, says, "Well, the only place we can put you waiting for the end of the game is on the field." On the field? Phil Griffin and I and our two-man camera crew spent the last three innings of the decisive game of the 1982 American League East pennant race in play. We were a grounds rule. On the field, cowering behind the Orioles dugout, praying there wouldn't be a pop-up or a line drive. We got our shots of the Brewers, and we followed them into their clubhouse. We caught Sutton and Ted Simmons and Raleigh Fingers singing again and again, "California, here I come, right back where I started from." And that's all I could remember of the song. The rest of it was, na-na-na, na-na-na, na-na-na-na, again and again, time after horrifying time. So the four of us in the crew drive back to the CNN Bureau in Washington, and every time there's a lull in this conversation, somebody involuntarily starts singing, "California, here I come," until we are all ready to scream. The last time I talked to Phil Griffin was 3 years ago, and damn, but we didn't start singing that stupid song again.
I love when you say vivisect. This is my last one. Game 7, Stanley Cup Finals, June 14th, 1994. A hot, muggy Tuesday evening in Manhattan. The New York Rangers are on the verge of putting down the curse and picking up the cup. For the first time in 54 years, I was asked if I would like to be a part of the ESPN telecast. I said, sure. The first Ranger game I saw in person was April of 1984, and on that day, Ken Morrow has an overtime goal for the Islanders, beating the Rangers in the playoffs in Game 5.
You understand this gives you very little credence as a Ranger fan. I mean, listening to some guy in the cheap seats bellowing out at Phil Esposito as he takes a face-off against the diabetic Bobby Clark, "Hey, Espo, feed him some sugar!" That's being a Ranger fan, Ohio boy.
How about I start in with a Pot Van chant? Would that help?
Maybe not.
You know what I'm thinking is I wanted to be a part of Ranger history that night if they were going to win. That's one of the big reasons why I got into this business, being some part of sports history. Well, my assignment was not going to the Garden. It was going to the Polo Grounds bar on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I was there to do live reports about the game. Not at the game, about the game. I was there to add what they term flavor. Not exactly a choice assignment. Not exactly Al Michaels during the USA-Russia Olympic game, Keith was at, but I'd survive. During the course of the evening, I found one guy who was actually on his honeymoon who had decided he had to see the Rangers win. He offered $1,000 to get tickets. He couldn't get in. So he ends up at the bar with me. And I said, "What's your wife think about this?" And he said, "Well, I don't think she had a problem," until I said, "I can sleep with you any night." I can only sleep with a cup tonight.
Ugh.
Once the celebrating was over with, I was told by some Ranger fans that Mark Messier would bring the cup out to a bar. Well, we finally found out where the bar was, and we got there and we waited. And we waited. And then he finally arrived. I later found out that he had made a couple of pit stops with the cup, including one at a strip club, because, as he would later say, the cup doesn't get out very often. Everybody's taking their drink out of the cup, and it finally came around to my turn. I figured, all right, I got my tetanus shot. It's safe to drink. I asked Messier, what exactly did you put in the cup? And he said, if you have to ask, you're not a Ranger fan. To this day, I don't know what I drank that night. I do know I'm not allowed to ask Mark Messier.
I had been on SportsCenter for 4 days when he came over to my desk. Keith, I wanted to apologize, he said. I looked back at him blankly. I had known him professionally for 11 years, and all that time flashed through my mind, and this one was real easy. There wasn't one thing he needed to apologize for. I said something to somebody about you. This was chewing him up. His usually pale face was a little flush, and I was a little worried. About how you do the show. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said it. And not only that, I didn't mean it. I was just frustrated about something here, and I took it out on you, and I'm sorry. Whatever he had said, I had never taken it personally. Moreover, whatever he had said, nobody had said it to me, and I told him so. Doesn't matter, he said. I just wanted to make sure that if you did hear it, you knew I was sorry, and I didn't mean it, and I think it's great you're finally here. And that, in the short slice of life, anecdotal form, should tell you exactly who Tom Meese was. We lost him on a beautiful Wednesday in August last year. We lost him an hour after he'd been in the office he helped to build, in the parking lot, shooting the breeze with Charlie Steiner, one of the 20 or 30 or who knows how many SportsCenter anchors he helped to break in. We lost him in a swimming pool not 2 miles from the ESPN complex that couldn't possibly be standing if he hadn't slugged it out all those years when ESPN was something that the rest of us in sports media looked at best, sympathy. Tom Meese was one of the originals at SportsCenter and in the coverage of virtually every sport ESPN has ever televised. He laid the groundwork for all that followed. But even acknowledging this truth, Tom Meese was ESPN when ESPN wasn't cool. Somehow that demeans his contribution to what goes on at ESPN. I used to run into him at games and at strike negotiations when his network and my old one between them were not worth the price of basic cable. I had strong doubts about my longevity in this business, but he did not. Nice work on that was usually his greeting, even before the handshake. Football talks in 82, Dodgers-Mets playoffs in 88, the unnecessary, never-to-be-forgotten apology about nothing in 1992. The last time I saw him, not a month before he died, you said something 6 weeks ago about the Pirates, and I laughed my butt off. We didn't do all that many sports centers together. You talk faster than I do, he said during a commercial break once. How in the world are we ever going to fill a whole hour? But there were a couple of tough times for Tom during the year we overlapped on the show, and I just happened to be there, and I just happened to manage to make myself useful to him, maybe by just listening, and he never forgot it. I don't just mean he was pleasant or warm or supportive, all of which he was. I mean, he used to remind me of this trifling thing that I had done. He made me feel like it had been the grandest thing in the world. Hey, how are you and Dan holding up? I was watching the other day. You guys look beat. The shows are great, but are you holding up? Tom was on the road most of the winter, doing hockey games, NHL games, college games, pickup on a frozen pond if they would have let him. That crisp, even delivery bursting into genuine enthusiasm at every goal, at every brilliant save. And he did as many national telecasts of hockey as anybody on the continent. And the true benefit of that, of course, was that it meant days on end in the winter and virtually complete summers at home with his wife and his two daughters. One of the off-air originals at ESPN saw him the night before he died and said Tommy had said it again that evening, just as he always did. Every game he broadcast, every dollar he made, those were for his daughters. In an industry of transients, this was a stable, family man. These last few years, Tom Meese probably got the closest anyone in this business could get to having the perfect job. Enough money, enough work, enough fame, enough satisfaction from finally, enough hockey, and all that time with the family. He should have had more time. After all, he had two families to spend it with, really, and just how true that was, we learned and we felt at the occasion of his wake. Dan and I like to kid each other about needing hugs. Well, we were not kidding that night. Almost as sad as his passing was this simple fact. There will be generations who will lean on the network name to get some interview arranged or throw some weight around, and they will never realize that the particular brick they are leaning on was put there with great sweat and great toil and great love by Tom Meese. Nothing ESPN did, nothing ESPN ever became or ever will become, did not feel his skilled, direct, and professional touch. But moreover, Tom Meese was our friend and our colleague, and no words can describe his value to Dan and to me as individuals. And nothing and no one here will ever be the same without him. There are two charitable funds which we mention here in Tom's memory. The Meese Children's Trust will support his daughter's educations. It's located at P.O. Box 6811, East Brunswick, New Jersey, 08816-6811. 5% of what Dan and I are receiving for the book, The Big Show, and the audio program, The Big Show, is going to this fund. Tom's favorite charity, Help Children with Cancer. It's the Valerie Fund at 1878 Springfield Avenue, Maplewood, New Jersey, 07040.
A great tribute to Tom. And as you found out, long after I did, once he liked you, he would tell you his life story. You were part of his family, and that was the beauty. A very tough person to know, but boy, once he liked you, he was there. He was there for you for anything and everything. And also, thanks for the hug at his funeral. Probably the toughest time I've had ESPN-related in my 8 years there. It's been a very cathartic process, though, working with you on this, and I think that that's been the fortunate aspect, is that we do a show together, and I spend a hell of a lot of time with you, too much time, but I think knowing somebody, appreciating somebody, makes it far more enjoyable, and that's something that I think shows through each night on the telecast.
Well, of course, you're absolutely right, Dan.
Yeah, I know. You are a great one.
I'm a great one. What was your name again?
Yeah. Bill Patrick.
The cathartic experience, of course, leads to the healing process that we both hope someday to achieve after 5 years of doing this on a nightly basis and now branching out into the worlds of audio programming and books themselves. And I think that we've done a lot of damage in our regular media or medium, and now we've extended it to this field. I think we ought to be considered triple or even quadruple threats now.
Be careful when you're driving if you're listening to this book. And as is often the case on each night on SportsCenter, we make mistakes, and we're not afraid to shy away from those mistakes. Recording The Big Show...
Wait, we're not afraid to shy away from those mistakes?
No, we will tell you that we made those mistakes.
No, you said we're not afraid to shy away from those mistakes.
We're not shying away.
That was a Freudian slip if ever I heard one. We aren't afraid, and we won't shy away from those mistakes.
Shut up. You do not want me to beat you up on audio, do you?
Insert your sound effects here.
Biff, pow, sock.
That's just your knee by itself.
So we do make mistakes. We're not afraid to admit mistakes.
There it is.
Yes.
Okay, good.
And if you would like to hear the mistakes we made in recording this, we would like to leave you with a smile on your face. Here are the outtakes to The Big Show. Please laugh with us and at us.
At us?
At us.
Thank you.
You listen. Because I've got somebody's ass to kick.
But first you have to pull your head out of it. Well?
August 3rd, 1981. Keith makes CNN debut as fill-in for New York reporter Debbie Segura. First interview is with Mets manager Joe Torre. Anchorman Nick Charles, not recognizing Keith, looks into camera with great alarm.
And he wasn't the last one.
Oh. They put me on during the Morning Drive newscast, and the first name I ever had to pronounce in Morning Drive was the Ayatollah Khomeini. Ayatollah Khomeini.
90? That's what you said. That's a transcription
90.
Right there, Bob.
One blessed Sunday morning, as Dayton's best rock and roll station belted out the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Thank you.
Jaguar.
They put me on during...
gave this guy Coca-Cola.
Sorry. I got a little wacky.
You asked for it.
I know. They put me on during the Morning Drive newscast, and the first name I ever had to pronounce in the Morning Drive was the Ayatollah. They put me on doing the Morning Drive newscast, and the first name I ever had to pronounce in Morning Drive was the Ayatollah.
thank God sports found you.
I can say Barry Bonds, but I can't say the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Nikolai Habibulin.
Ayatollah. Okay. We still view whatever acclaim we've gotten as an unlikely gift that could go all the way.
No.
It could go. It could go all the way.
The Big Show, Inside ESPN Sports Center, was written and read by Keith Olbermann and Dan Patrick. It was abridged for audio by Matt Fenton. The recording engineer was Paul Fowley, with editing and post-production by Michael Jones. The associate producer was Florence Barreau Adams. The Big Show was produced and directed by Karen Frillman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Big Show, Inside ESPN Sports Center, is also available in book form from Pocket Books.